The subject matter in this episode may not be suitable for young listeners, so please be advised and use your discretion accordingly.
Being a ministry wife is a vocation without a job description. And let's be honest, sometimes it seems like ministry might be easier if we did have one. If you are a ministry wife like me and are looking for hope, perspective, and a little bit of practical advice regarding your role, you're in the right place. Hi, I'm Christine Hoover, author of How to Thrive as a Pastor's Wife. Welcome to the Ministry Wives Podcast, a production of the North American Mission Board. Join me as we hear from guests from various ministry contexts, having authentic conversations about our shared joys and challenges, even the ones we're unsure we can talk about. No topic is off limits. My guest today is Trevin Wax. Trevin is Vice President of Research and Resource Development at the North American Mission Board, which means he works on the Ministry Wives podcast. He's also a visiting professor at Cedarville University and a former missionary to Romania. Trevin is also a prolific writer. He has a regular column at the Gospel Coalition and has contributed to the Washington Post, Religion News Service, World, and Christianity Today. He has also served as general editor of the Gospel Project and has taught courses on mission and ministry at Wheaton College. Trevin is obviously, based upon his bio, a deep thinker and has done a lot of thinking around cultural apologetics, which he will define in our conversation today. I asked Trevin to come on the podcast to help us in these changing times to understand and to respond to the culture around us. How can we study our culture? How can we understand why people around us believe what they believe? And how can we speak the gospel to them in a compelling and beautiful way? That's what Trevin and I chat about today. So let's dive in. Here, friends, is my conversation with Trevin Wax. Well, I'm so excited to get to welcome Trevin Wax to the Ministry Wives podcast. Hi, Trevin.
Hi, Christine. Really honored to be here.
You're one of the few men who have made it onto the Ministry Wives podcast. So
well, even more honored then.
Yeah. Well, also, you are somewhat of, I mean, I guess I could call you somewhat of a boss to me. You helped bring about the Ministry Wives podcast a few years ago.
Yeah, I like to think of it more like partners, co-laborers, you know, working alongside. I mean, God's already given you such an amazing ministry, and it really is exciting to be able to have you on board with, you know, a lot of great things that are happening in the North American Mission Board too.
Yeah, so tell us about your job at the North American Mission Board.
Yeah, so I oversee a small team. We do research and resource development for pastors, for planters. We oversee the site newchurches.com, for example, that has like, you know, video courses and ebooks and articles all for free for pastors, church leaders, potential church planters or current church planters. And then we help with like on the disaster relief, the compassion side of the North American Mission Board as well, like with Send Relief. We do videos for them. We help out with the evangelism team. We do a number of podcasts as well. So it's just it's a bunch of things, and it's a small team, but we interact with a lot of the great folks at the North American Mission Board. And I like to call my team like this team of ninjas, because they're able to get so much done because of the experience and expertise that they bring. It's really fun to be part of it.
Yeah. A small but mighty team.
Yes, that's right.
Do you have other resources besides Ministry Wives that women who are listening could go and check out? New Churches, do they have stuff for the wives and for women in ministry there?
We do. In fact, a lot of the stuff that you'll find on New Churches, I mean, there's things geared toward, you know, the church planter's family. There's things geared around, you know, creating a welcome environment kind of for the church. Some things related to children's ministry. And then, but there's a lot there that you would find in the articles that are just, it's just going to be applicable to anybody that's part of a church planting team. Because like, as you know, it's not one person planting a church. And not even one couple planting a church,
right,
really. Although it can sometimes feel that way for the planter. It really comes around to all people stewarding their gifts for the sake of the mission. And so, yeah, there's a lot there that I think would be helpful for people that are involved in the church planting journey.
Yeah. So listeners, y'all go check that out, because there's stuff there for you. But also, Trevin, you're kind of a jack of all trades. You do a lot of stuff. You're a writer, podcaster, When I think of you, I think of a deep thinker. You're a thinker who then synthesizes a lot of information for us to help us understand different things. And one of the things I want to talk to you about today is your work in cultural apologetics, which, first of all, we just need you to define what that is.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. In fact, I've had to kind of brush up on that as well, because recently I became a fellow for the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics. And I was, you know, and there's talk even among the fellows and the different apologists and Christian leaders in that group as to what, all apologetics is cultural to some extent.
Yeah.
And so you've got to ask that question, like, how does this differ from sort of more traditional apologetics? I think the way I would say it is that, you know, when you think of apologetics and the kind of the ministry area, you're tending to think about making arguments to defend, you know, the major truth claims of Christianity, right? So if there are people that are wondering about the existence of God, then you have, you know, rational arguments. You're trying to lead people logically to understand, you know, the existence of God or the resurrection of Jesus or why we should believe what the Bible teaches about this thing or that thing. I think the cultural apologetics angle to this adds a little bit more of what I would say would be the imagination and the understanding that, you know, we are, we've got to have this intersection of goodness and beauty alongside truth, so that people we're not just trying to convince someone rationally that Christianity is true, but we're also trying to understand the deepest longings of people, the lies of our society that people will run toward in order to fulfill those longings, and how the light of the gospel exposes some of those lies, but also gets to those deeper longings at the same time. Like, it shows that those longings are fulfilled in Jesus. And so I think the cultural apologetics angle is about treating people as whole people and understand, yeah, and asking the question, like, what is the good life? What is the satisfying life? How are we to be satisfied in the gospel? So it opens up different avenues for inroads into conversations with people than more your traditional apologetics, which tends to focus on logic and reason and whatnot, which, again, that's a huge part of apologetics. The cultural piece, I think, just extend, it's like different clubs if you're playing golf, like, you've got different tools in the toolkit that you can pull out. And I think this is one of those that is helpful in our time.
Yeah. And so for the listener, we're talking to pastors' wives, ministry wives, and they're maybe thinking, what does this have to do with me? And hopefully they're already making the connection, but it has everything to do with us in our ministry work on the ground, right? So what would you say is the significance of a ministry wife understanding cultural apologetics?
Well, I would zero in on the culture side, and I would, and in two ways. In one, I would say, if you're trying to reach out to people who have either left the church or have never been to church or are, you know, secular or of another religion or whatnot, then you're trying to bring your faith into a missionary encounter with people in your culture, in that society. And in order to do that really well, you've got to be comprehensible. And the way to make that connection, of course, through relationship and friendship and hospitality and all sorts of ways, but you're also, you want to know, like, what makes this person tick?
Yeah.
Right? Like, what are they looking for? And where does the gospel intersect with that? Like, what are the questions they're asking? So I think on the one side, so anyone who's in ministry is having to think about reaching out to people in that culture. But then there's that second component that I think is super important and that I don't think we give enough attention to. And it's that Christians are not just called to reach the culture. We've got to bring a culture of our own, mm-hmm, to the world. The church is to be a kind of culture. So the cultivation, like, so just reaching out to a neighbor, for example, to bring them into your home, is a wonderful way of reaching out, but you better have a good culture of the home to bring them into, right? Like, there's like the hospitality aspect of this and the way that the church, you know, is together. Like, the church is itself a culture within a culture. It's the counterculture. And so, sometimes we think of just as culture as something out there that we are to engage, while we also don't recognize that we are to make and create culture in here, in our own families, in our own churches, that itself is a really powerful way of demonstrating the beauty of the gospel for people to see.
That's really good. I like that you're saying be intentional about really studying and knowing what people around you are longing for, how they define the good life is how you described it, but then also being intentional in the choices you make in your family and in your churches so that you're kind of answering those questions or you're reflecting back to them in some ways that causes them to have to think about what they think, if that makes sense. That's how I'm thinking of it. But so I'd like to break that up into two parts and first talk about how can we be intentional in studying the culture. So this was super important for us in church planting because we moved from, even though we were still in the U.S., I felt we had moved from one culture to another. So as soon as we landed on the ground, we did a parachute church plant. And I realized people here think differently. They respond differently to different things. They care about different things than what the culture I came from. And so I had to be really intentional about asking some questions to try to be able to even relate to people. So I'd love for you to speak to that. How would you encourage us to begin to discover what is it that my kind of microculture values?
I think that's such a great question that you're asking about the particular region that you're in,
yes,
or the people that you're called to reach. And I think with the very fact that you felt that sense of disorientation means that you were thinking like a missionary. Because at the end of the day, you know, and I've done work for several years overseas and I've been in different parts of the United States. It like you've, when you go into a place and you're wanting to be, you know, a gospel presence and a gospel proclaimer, you know, then you've got to ask those kinds of questions. We expect missionaries to do that overseas. I think people are surprised when they have to do it even here. And even I would even say for listeners who are not necessarily called to leave one particular place and go to another, it may be harder, but it's still really important for them to think about the cultural milieu that they're in. It's yes. actually sometimes easier for someone like you who transplants yeah. like parachutes into another place, because if you, it's kind of like you go from one fishbowl to another and it's like, oh, this water's different.
Yes.
For a lot of people, they don't know the water around them because they're just fish swimming in the water like everyone else. And so it's that sense of disorientation can actually be really helpful. And if you don't have that sense of disorientation in your own cultural environment, because it's where you've grown up and it's where you've ministered for a long time, then it's really important to talk to people from other fishbowls, so to speak, so that you're able to see they're able to help you see the things you can't see in your own culture. So you can see through things, you can note things, you can begin to recognize like what will resonate with people, what will not resonate with people, like what are people searching for here. And of course, every individual is different. There's a little bit of a danger whenever we talk about cultures and we sort of flatten distinctions
yeah.
because like when people talk about the culture of like a big city, you know, I was in New York a couple of weeks ago. I mean, it depends on the street you're living
yeah.
in as to what the culture is going to be like, you know, the different ethnicities everywhere and the different cultures that different immigrants bring to a community. So it's really important to have that larger focus on culture, but then to get really specific in conversations in the neighborhood with people that you're in, and even different homes in the neighborhood will have different cultures. So think on the macro level and then think of the micro level. And you do that through a lot of listening, a lot of reading, a lot of praying, and a lot of conversation, I think, with people that are well-equipped to be able to help you navigate different cultural waters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll give you an example of some of the things that I started noticing and asking as an outsider, but I would love for you to then give us for people who've been in a place for 10, 15 years, what are some things they can ask themselves to help them pay attention to the culture around them? So for me, what I started noticing when we moved to Charlottesville is that almost every car had tons of bumper stickers. It was crazy. Also personalized license plates. I don't know. But I started reading them. I would almost get into accidents because I'm trying to figure out what their license plate says. But the bumper stickers I started realizing were in themes. A lot of them were about leisure activity, like the mountains or the beaches that were close to where we were. One of the other themes was politics. Politics is very important. And it was all one-sided politics, bumper stickers. And the third one was dogs. Everybody loved their dogs. They loved dogs. We always joked people love their dogs more there than they love children. Children were annoying in public places, but dogs were highly valued and they would have be invited in and, you know, that kind of thing. And so that sounds really silly to say. Those are three themes that I saw, but I started that really helped me to begin to understand this is what people do with their time. This is what people are going to talk about. This is what's important to them. And so if I'm going to engage them in conversation, it's probably going to be around one of those things in order to kind of begin to have conversation. Another thing, just with the leisure, I noticed that a lot, that there were people gone a lot on the weekends. And so it was like the way people interacted and how they engaged was very different than where I'd come from. So those are some of the things that I started seeing and asking the question, how can I then go where people are or engage in a way that doesn't go against my convictions or my values, but I can engage in that. Where are places in Charlottesville I can be in that kind of sense? Because that's what people are going to be doing. So what would you say for somebody who is in the same place? What are some questions they can ask themselves to kind of parse out culture and what people are thinking about, talking about?
Yeah, I think the questions that I would point to, those kinds of observations you mentioned, I think are just our goal at helping people understand, okay, these are some of the things that I see make people tick. And this is some of the things that are valuable, that mean a lot to people in this particular society. I think the other things that you can tease out in conversations, and I don't mean like when you're talking with people, like having like this checklist of things that you're going to like walk down to, like basically like you're doing a survey trying to get to know someone. But in conversations with people, it can become clear as you ask questions, what are these person's hopes? What are their fears? How do they narrate the story of their life? If you ask them about themselves, do they immediately go to family? Do they immediately go to their career? You know, what is it that, like, when they look out over their life and they're talking about steps forward and steps back, is that in terms of career? Is it in terms of money? Is it in terms of status? Is it in terms of success in this particular area or not? Is it in terms of leisure and the ability to be able to be out this many weekends versus that many weekends? Like, once you start to figure out how someone, they'll give you glimpses into the story, into the book that is their life, the different chapters and like what's happened in the past and where they've come and where they are and what they want, what they hope the next chapter will be and all of that. And you can kind of begin to see, it's like you get without them showing you their diary, they're actually showing you the way that they are thinking through their life story. And I think asking questions that get to some of that and some of those cues, I think is what's super important to really being able to get to know someone well.
Mm-hmm. What you just said is going straight to the heart of a person. So are you saying that we should go there straight away? Like, help me understand practically how that might look. Maybe what questions you ask that would build and get to that layer?
Yeah, no, I think you start with observational questions based on the things you mentioned when you talked about bumper stickers and stuff. Because like if you see someone's really, you know, very motivated politically, whether on one side or the other, you know, you can ask questions like, so, you know, what do you think about this? Oh, tell me more about that. Like, why do you think this way? Or what do you think about that? Where you're not really engaging right or wrong at this point. You're just asking particular questions to kind of, you know, to get them to talk about what's important to them. Because one of the things you'll notice with politics in our day and age is that it has become almost as important as religion.
Yes.
When it comes to someone's self-understanding. In fact, one of the stats is just mind-blowing to me is that there are more Americans today say they would have a bigger problem with their son or daughter marrying someone of the opposite political party than someone from another religion. That's crazy to me. And people say, well, that just shows politics is more important than religion. And I want to say, no, that shows that politics is the religion for a lot of people. So you can't look at politics in those conversations though, and say that's sort of like a, a wall or a deal breaker to having conversations, you're engaging someone who's super involved and this is a big part of their life and you're asking those questions. So I'd say start with observations and then you move forward. Over time, you get to the bigger, you know, the story questions I was talking about with narration and things like that. It may be on the surface at the beginning about, you know, going away for a weekend or like having a dog or, you know, how you vote or something like that at the surface level. But the more you talk with someone, the more you'll have opportunities to be able to see sort of how they plot the trajectory of their life. And that's really where you have ends, I think, for gospel conversations. Mm-hmm.
So the other side of this you're saying is, or the way I imagine what you're saying is that we're listening to them and we're understanding their culture, but then we're inviting them into the counterculture, which is the Christian worldview. It is the biblical worldview. And I don't mean just, with our reasoning, but with how we live, our home culture, our church culture. So how do we transition from, okay, I'm asking you these questions, but now I want to bring this truth with beauty into your perspective and ask you to consider that. So how do we do that?
You know, there are different ways. People have different views on the best way to do this. And I'm kind of partial I tend to be really upfront, and I find, and not every culture it's like this, but when I'm getting to know someone and we're, you know, developing a friendship or we're, you know, beginning to talk somewhat, like, you know, next week, for example, I've got, a lunch appointment with, someone who I think is basically just sort of a cultural Christian who's not actually a born again believer, would probably identify as a Christian. But the way I do it with my personality and whatnot, it's mm-hmm. just, it doesn't, I don't think it comes across as like abrasive or like, it's sort of, hey, if you're going to get to know me, you're going to hear about Jesus at some level, because there's really no way to get to know me without that aspect, right? Like that, my life, and I hope we would all say this, that we don't want our lives to make sense apart from how Jesus plays a role in our life, like how he's involved. So basically, without like doing it in a really disarming way to where it's just a part of you, like you're not trying to hide it. There's no bait and switch. You're just bringing your full self to the conversation as well. I have found that that's, you know, for a lot of people, it's refreshing and they don't feel like necessarily you're trying to sell them something or trying to, you know, you're bringing your whole self. And then when you invite them into the community, you're inviting them to witness something that, or to experience something that really is impossible except through the church community. And so this is one of the, you know, a lot of people will complain that, well, everybody should be such a great personal evangelist that, you know, evangelism isn't just inviting people to church. And I hear that. And I want to say, yes, we should, you know, train people to know how to walk through the gospel and understand the basics of the gospel and all those conversations, and totally am on board with that. But when people say it's not just inviting people to church, I want to say, but that is a really powerful way of helping someone understand the beauty and power of the gospel. Like when you're suddenly in this place with lots of people who believe that Jesus was raised from the dead and they're singing their hearts out to him, like there's something really powerful about that. Like I don't want to, there's an evangelistic tug in a really good church culture. And so, and I think that's a challenge for us. Like, is that our church culture?
Right.
Like, you know, like, are we basically going out to like reach the culture, but then we're bringing them in and we don't really have a beautiful culture of our own to bring them into? That's why we've got to do work on both the fronts, the reaching out and the cultivation.
Yes. That's so good. I remember realizing that in church planting, realizing, wow, there's people around us in our church who've come in who are not believers. And the most important thing for them is not what I necessarily say. It's what we say. It's what we do. It's a team effort. I think that's what you're saying. It's just how we love each other, how we have hope, you know, how we worship. All those things are so important that we're living that our faith for in front of these people. So can you speak to that as far as ministry wives go? How can we contribute to that culture? What are some of the things that you would say is important for us to consider? Because we have influence, but many of us are not actually in leadership of the church. And so what can we do to contribute to that?
Yeah, I tend to be one of these. I tend to flatten some distinctions when it comes to the definition of leadership. I think there are a whole lot more women in leadership in the church that don't realize they are, because we think in terms of sort of a formal, like, on the church website kind of leaders, and then we think of, you know, everybody else. And I have been in churches, many churches over the years, where the most influential people in the church were not on the website, and both for good and for bad at times, and both men and women. Right. So this is one of those areas where I think we've got to almost have like a framework shift to realize in our mindset that, there's a lot of leadership that is being exerted in congregations that doesn't come with sort of formal titles or staff positions or, you know, working for the church and whatnot. But I mean, when you think about Sunday school teachers and youth volunteers and chaperones on a camp, I mean, what the parents that go on, you know, to camp with the like, they are huge culture makers.
Yes.
When I think about my own experiences, you know, going back to youth group days and whatnot, and I think of student ministry, I think about a lot of the teenagers that were with me, but I also think about those parents who would open up their homes for, you know, a Disciple Now weekend kind of a thing and things like that. So all that to say is, if you're in the church and you're listening to this podcast, you are a leader in your church.
Yes.
And you need to lean into that and recognize that God has given you a sphere of influence. And that is a massively important sphere of influence. You can think of it, and you should just ask yourself the question, where is my influence in this church most felt? And what influence do I want to be? Because I'm just afraid with the informality of it, we lose the intentionality of it too. Mm-hmm. And you can be an influence unintentionally, but you're more likely to be a good influence when you have good intentionality behind, you know, where it is. So asking yourself the question, what is the sphere of authority, the sphere of leadership, the sphere of influence that God has given me? And, you know, and for a season, it may be, it's my husband and my kids. I've got like four kids at home and they're all under this age, and they're, you know, or things like that. It may for a while be predominantly the family. But looking out, being asking that question year after year, what spheres of influence has God given me? Where has He called me? Then looking at that, and then intentional mindset around cultivating what that's going to look like. I just think we undercut the vast amounts of influence that take place in the church that are not formal. And we really, really need to rethink that if we're going to be effective in the days ahead.
Yes. Thank you for saying that. I think that's absolutely true. And I especially think it's true in this area of cultural apologetics, because I think about with church planting, with ministry, the most important place that I've done that is in my home, is bringing people into my home, or building the culture in my family when my kids were little, so that when people come in, they see what, you know, I'm not doing it for them to see it, but we've built a culture in our home that I want to invite people into to be a part of. The most important place I have done that is my home. And so women, I think especially because we're using this word beauty and goodness, I think women especially bring that aspect, not that men can't, but I love what you're saying, because it's just a charge to women listening to say, this is on your plate. You know, you can, with whatever God's given you, use it to bring people in to the culture of the church and into your family. That's a huge ministry, and has been my primary ministry in all of our years of ministry. So thanks for saying that. I'd love for you to help us through a practical example. So one of the things, I think we've talked about politics, that could be one we could talk about, or a big one is gender and sexuality. These are two huge conversations, especially with another election coming up. And so how can we do these things practically? Can you walk us through, you choose one of those examples of, okay, we're interacting with our neighbors. They value a certain thing. We've kind of discovered what that is. How do we talk to them about that and understand their perspective? And then how do we demonstrate and display the beauty and the goodness of the gospel in that area?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that, boy, we could go for a long time on different things. And I don't claim to have all the answers on this. This is, I think, different people in different regions and different cultures are trying to work out the best way to do this. I'd say first we come with our convictions that we know what the Bible teaches. We know what the church has taught about the nature of being made man and woman, male and female in God's image. At a lot of the debates in the church over sexuality and different denominations and whatnot are really, it's not the debate over sexuality. It's really a debate over humanity. Hmm. Like, what do our bodies mean? What does it mean to be embodied? Like, what, and what's the intention behind that? What is God? God declares us good as male and female. What does that mean? What does marriage then mean from that? So the tip of the iceberg is sort of sexuality and marriage and things like that. But underneath that is a whole, you know, we call it the anthropological iceberg is underneath that. That's the real where the real debate is. And so I think we start with the convictions that God has created us in His image, embodied, and that His creation is good. We're not Gnostics. We believe the body really does matter. Mm-hmm. And so you're not just a feeling. You are, you know, like your body and soul, you're in, you know, connected. And that's the way it's supposed to be. So I think we start with the convictions, and then we look for ways to have conversation. And we recognize, because we live in a fallen world, there's going to be a lot of confusion that requires compassion. So I think we start with the convictions, and then we seek to engage with compassion when, you know, we shouldn't be surprised, for example, in a pornified culture like we live in, there's going to be all sorts of confusion. Think about adolescents and all the messages that they hear being bombarded on every front. Think about the access to pornography that kids have at such a young age. Is there any like, you know, surprise that there would be, you know, confusion and sort of the, like, even the way like the brain is wired for, like, suddenly there to be all kinds of attractions that they're trying to figure out, like, who they are. Like, am I gay? Am I straight? Am I non-binary? Am I a girl trapped in a guy's body? Like, what? Like, all of those are questions that are the downstream effects of the sexual revolution and a lot of the challenges that we face in a world that prioritizes sort of your inner spark and essence over what it means for you to live within the God-given good constraints of the body. And we recognize, though, that fallenness is real. And so we shouldn't be shocked or surprised or react with, you know, condemnation when we see people struggling. I think where the church has a difficult time on the sexuality questions is that you often have two sets of people, and they're going to require different kinds of responses. On the one hand, you've got some people who are struggling and who need, you know, who really just need people in community with compassion, walking them through particular struggle, helping them through confusion, helping them understand what God's word says, and being willing to. I say for people like that, if they're non-Christian, you've got to be willing to basically be the bigot or the bad guy. Like, you got to understand from their understanding, the traditional Christian view of sex and marriage is overly restrictive. They might even say repressive, harmful to people, and also, you know, discriminatory in some way. So because of that, they're going to immediately label you on that side. Even people that are struggling. I think the call of the Christian there is, can you basically blow up all their categories? Like, can you basically show through your conversations, through your compassion, can you basically, like, not necessarily that you're going to convince them necessarily, or that you need to be arguing about this all the time, but can you show them from your life that you're not sort of this caricature of a person that they have in their mind? So, that's one of the areas in which we'll have a lot of work to do. But then the other, so you've got the people sort of struggling through this, walking through this, or they're you know, the sort of the conviction with compassion side. But then you also do have like activists who are very politically forceful. I mean, they're moving into all sorts of areas. They're, you know, there are states debating whether or not, you know, young children should be able to be taken from their parents if their parents disagree with a gender transition. I mean, like total all out culture war at this point. On, in some cases, what has traditionally been seen as, you know, not just a Christian, but a worldwide understanding of embodiedness. And in those cases, I think sometimes we tend to treat everyone as one category or the other. Like we tend to look at anybody who has a different view on this and we see them in the activist camp. And most people just are not. Like most of the conversations that you have with people, they may have a they may have imbibed a certain view of sex and gender and, you know, and you know, sexuality or whatnot, but they're not necessarily an activist out there trying to, you know, take away your church's, you know, tax exemption or something or trying to, you know, convince kids that they need to be, you know, blocking puberty and stuff. Like that's just not most people. But then you do have the activist side that's out there. And so I think what happens is at times we get those categories conflated and we basically, we do the same thing we accuse them of doing, is that we create a caricature in in our own mind of, well, anybody who thinks this way, there's a large spectrum of thought on all of this. And I have found that when you actually have the conversations with real flesh and blood people and not just, you know, online and whatnot, you just find that it's a whole lot more complicated. And there are some areas of common ground that are a lot stronger that you can find. I mean, no one wants to harm kids, right? And so if you recognize that, you actually have common ground even with someone who you think they are harming kids by what they're prescribing kids, and they think you're harming kids by not doing that, but you actually do agree, we don't want to harm kids. Like that's why we're having the conversation. I think looking for that kind of common ground to keep conversations open is really strong, and try to blow up the categories and the caricatures along the way.
I like that. Blow up the caricatures, both ourselves and them. Have the conversations. Look for common ground. And also, you said earlier we should look for, what is the longing? What is the what do they consider the good life? So how, what would be the longing behind this specific topic that you think people are looking for to be filled?
Well, a lot of it is different depending on the person. I mean, one of the challenging things is if you look behind the question of sexuality to the question of identity, a lot of it is the longing is, this is the way I'm going to find purpose and meaning in my life, is that I'm going to be true to myself, whoever myself is whoever I've determined myself is going to be. And we just happen to define ourselves by our deepest desires. And so like, I am my desires. So, but we, people do that. I mean, just bracket the sexuality question.
We,
like,
do
people
do
that related to any kind of desires. In fact, in the church, it happens all the time. So, so like that's the deeper longing that's there, where then as Christians, we've got to be able to come in and recognize that when we see it. And then be able to, what I like to say is, uncover the areas of anxiety that come about from that way of life. Because there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of, if you living your best life is all up to you, then really, I mean, if you're not feeling happy and fulfilled and feeling like you've gotten in touch with your deepest desires and you're living them out and expressing them out and getting all of that affirmation, you're either going to blame people for not affirming you in your desires, whatever they might be, or your trajectory in life or the decisions that you make, or you're going to blame yourself because your desires are in conflict at times. You can't have everything you want. You've got to figure out what kind of desires you should be more inclined to or toward versus not. So you can see the areas of anxiety and the loneliness that comes about in a culture all around us.
Yes.
It's everywhere. And so I recommend people, you know, the book I wrote on this topic, Rethink Yourself, is really about that. Like, where are those areas of anxiety? And then how does the gospel speak to those? Cause I feel like that's the end.
Yes.
In having those conversations.
Everybody, I mean, these days our age is characterized by anxiety.
Yes.
So yes, that's very helpful. Uncover the anxiety, the area of anxiety. It makes me think of the book Love Thy Body. Have you read that, Nancy?
Yes.
What's the last name?
Nancy Piercy. Yeah.
Piercy. Such a good book. If you're listening and you're like, I want to grow in my understanding of this area in a Christian worldview, I would suggest Love Thy Body. She talks a lot about how we've divided the mind, the soul from the body, and how that's actually not a biblical understanding. So check that out. But also, you've written on this too. So let's close with just tell us where we can find more information. You have a podcast, you have books related to some of this.
Yes. So I've done a podcast like you with North American Mission Board. It's called Reconstructing Faith. And that podcast it's really about the credibility crisis facing the church today. And in a number of areas. I mean, we dig into a bunch of them, everything from the conversations around, leadership style, race, political engagement, the sex abuse scandals in the church, purity culture and all of that, falling for the American dream, all sorts of things. We basically look at this moment that we're in, and we try to, and I try to bring on some voices and clips and different things so that people can follow along with what is it going to look like for us to build a healthier church in the future. So that's something, working on a second season for that now, but that's the first thing. And then, I've just got different books, like the Thrill of Orthodoxy, Rethink Yourself. This Is Our Time. It goes into a little more of the detail about the longings and lies conversation that we've had, where we've talked about, getting to those deeper longings and showing how the gospel then exposes some of those lies that we believe, helping people understand cultural narratives. So yeah, all of that's near and dear to my heart, and hopefully will be helpful if anyone picks up any of those.
Absolutely. And I would just say to close, this is so important for us as ministry wives, just for you women listening, we want to be deep thinkers to understand how we can engage people around us. And this is just such a helpful start, but I would say, let's dig deeper. Let's be intentional about knowing what we believe, knowing how to engage people who are thinking differently around us, but also creating and cultivating that healthy counterculture, as Trevin said. Trevin, thank you so much for joining me for Ministry Wives.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Ministry Wives podcast, a production of the North American Mission Board. I would love to hear from you. We are creating an episode full of our listeners' funniest or most embarrassing moments in ministry. Record and send your story to me at the link in the show notes. And don't forget, if you found this content helpful, please rate and review us on your podcast platform or share it with a friend. You can find this podcast and other helpful resources at ministrywivespodcast.com.
So what we want to do today was have some follow-up questions from those things.
And you know more about my life than I do right now, so it's all right.
Dr. Tony Evans is an internationally acclaimed preacher and author. Listen to his story from the very beginning, start to finish, the life and ministry of Dr. Tony Evans. Episodes drop soon. Subscribe wherever and however you listen.